This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Gernot Wagner, an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he works on market-based solutions to a wide range of environmental problems. Gernot teaches energy economics at Columbia and graduated from both Harvard and Stanford. Gernot Wagner is here today to tell us about his newly published book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. Welcome, Gernot.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What led you to write your book, But Will the Planet Notice?
A general frustration. And frustration with essentially how I and many other environmentalists look at the world, which is that we see these daunting problems, and in response to it, we essentially retreat and recycle, refuse plastic bags, don't eat out-of-season grapes, buy the local apples and carry them home in our canvas bags, and sort of try to do all the right things. But then when you actually look at the numbers, when you try to add it up, it simply doesn't. We need to do much, much more than that. And that's the gist of the book, right? Does what we do on a daily basis actually make the planet notice? Or, and this of course is the argument here, do we need fundamental policy change to make the planet notice?
Would you elaborate on why individual actions are inadequate to successfully address environmental issues?
Well, it depends on the environmental issue, of course, right? If you are worried about plastic bag waste in your backyard, well, you individually not tossing plastic bags in your backyard is probably the right solution right there, right? But once you scale it up to something like global warming, well, newsflash, recycling won't stop global warming. That's the real problem here. Once you go to something at the scale of global warming or global overfishing for that matter, individual action, what you and I do personally, simply doesn't add up to enough.
Is that partly because not everyone is going to participate in those activities?
It is, right? Of course, that too, right? So you can get, everyone in Seattle and Brooklyn, New York to recycle, right? And Boulder and Berkeley, perhaps. But it'll be tough to get 7 billion to do that, right? That's one. But equally important, even if, a billion people did the right thing, a billion people recycled and didn't drive and all the rest of it, it still wouldn't be enough given current technologies and given the way we organize ourselves as a society right now.
To protect the environment, what are some of the key ways our current economic system needs to be altered overall?
The key point here is that what we do right now on a massive, massive scale is we privatize benefits and socialize costs. So right when I fly from New York to Seattle, the emissions, the about half a ton of CO2 emissions that one flight causes, everyone else pays for the cost. I don't. And even more importantly, even if I choose to pay for that, right, even if I voluntarily pay the $20 to offset the emissions from that flight, it still won't be enough, right? It doesn't incentivize the airline to fly any more efficient planes or doesn't do anything along these lines. My individual action simply doesn't matter in this case.
In your book, you indicate that markets are needed to save the planet. Why do you think markets are needed?
That pretty much gets the gist of this argument here. So when you look at overfishing, for example, the reason why overfishing is a problem, for the most part, is because fish out in the sea is free. Now, turns out there's a pretty simple solution to this. For example, when you compare tuna, bluefin tuna, to lobster, bluefin tuna is at the verge of extinction. Lobster isn't. And the reason essentially is that we can fairly easily assign property rights over lobster. They don't move, right? So they move maybe a mile or two or so a year, lobster off the coast of New England, whereas bluefin tuna swims hundreds of miles. So when you don't catch a lobster today, chances are pretty good it'll be there for you next year when it's bigger and you can actually make more money off it, and at the same time you're preserving the stock. Bluefin tuna, right, you don't catch it today, someone else will catch it tomorrow. You can't actually manage that species as easily as lobster, for example. And what markets do is ensure that, in this case, there is a market for fish out on the sea. There are property rights assigned to fish out in the sea, and that allow you to essentially manage the species as if it actually had value out in the sea, which of course it does. Lack of markets, lack of property rights means that we treat fish out in the sea as if it was a free resource for the taking. That's a real problem.
Would you speak about how the halibut fisheries in Alaska came to be managed in a sustainable way?
That's a pretty good example, sort of a trial and error run, as it were. So halibut, a decade or so ago, had a real problem, and the problem that many fishers are facing, which was dramatic overfishing. And while the regulator came in and said, okay, well, let's try to do something here, right? It's a problem that we have these factory ships going out to sea and raping the ocean. Now, the first solution they found was, how about we just restrict technology? And the answer was that it was a constant race now suddenly between the regulator and the regulated. So yes, the newest satellite-guided ships were no longer allowed to use in this particular fishery, but fishermen just used more boats in exchange for that. So that clearly doesn't work, right? So the direct intervention in regulating technology didn't work. Another way of doing this, perhaps, is to just restrict fishing days, right? Instead of be able to fish the entire season, just fish for a few days of the year. Well, it turned out for the halibut fishery, we had to go down to 2 days, 48 hours, where the fishery was open, and it was literally, it was a race in the end, right? So you can just imagine the image here. You have these fishermen sort of putting on sort of sleepy surfs and trying to get ready for these 2 days when they could finally go out and race to catch as much fish as possible. Now, of course, as a result of this, first of all, the fishery, in effect, didn't exist anymore, right, if it was only around for 2 days of the year. And once everyone came back with their catch, with their annual catch after these 48 hours, well, prices for the fish were pretty low, right? You basically flood the market with all the halibut you could find over those 2 days. So after, you know, more trial and error, in the end, what the regulator came up with was a system called catch shares. And that, at the end, is the most successful, the best way of managing any of these fisheries. It is scientists determining the maximum catch that is scientifically viable, and then the local fisheries council or the regulator hands out shares in that catch to fishermen, and it's no longer a race now. Now, well, you have a property right, you have the right to fish a certain amount, and it's no longer a race where you have to fish as much as possible in 48 hours. Now you can do it over the course of the entire season, over the entire year. Fishery becomes much more relaxed in many ways. But of course, you know, this isn't socialist nirvana here. This is the exact opposite. This is free markets in the purest sense of the word. Now you suddenly have a true market for fishing out on the sea. And it was an extremely successful system in the case of halibut, and now been duplicated for many other fisheries around the nation and around the world.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Gernot Wagner, author of the book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What do you see as the best way to balance regulation and market forces for positive environmental outcomes?
We can pretty much go back to the Clean Air Act here, the Clean Air Act of 1970, as a pretty good example of extremely successful legislation. If you just applied hard-nosed economic analysis here, and looked at the effect of GDP, gross domestic product, in 2010, 40 years later, you would find that the Clean Air Act of 1970 increased GDP in 2010 by about 1.5%. Well, now it essentially turns out that it's not a good idea to poison our children. And if you don't do that, if you protect their health, it makes for more productive workers later on. So 40 years later, GDP is up as a result. Overall, benefits of the Clean Air Act exceed costs to the tune of around 30-1. For every $1 invested, you get $30 of benefits. And that's really the general pattern here. There was the Clean Air Act of 1970 that had this ratio. The Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 had a very similar ratio, 30-1, or at least 30-1. And both of these laws are actually fairly good indications of what ought to be done to protect our health and our air in this case, and what is extremely sensible both from the environmental public health standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint.
You are a proponent of cap and trade as a tool to help address climate change. What do you see as the key benefits of cap and trade?
The key benefit in the end is that it is the most cost-effective, the most efficient way of reducing as much in terms of emissions as possible at the least cost. So if you just focus on ethics here, the most ethical thing to do is to reduce emissions as much as possible. And cap and trade, creating a market, an emissions market, is in fact one of the ways that thus does most effectively. Now, turns out another equivalent or theoretically equivalent way here is to basically price emissions. So if you look at something like gas taxes, a tax on every gallon of fuel, there in fact a gas tax, a direct tax on fuel, on emissions, is the better approach. But overall, for something like sulfur dioxide pollutions to address acid rain, carbon dioxide to address global warming, emissions market, a firm limit on emissions, and then allowing firms who are covered by this system to essentially find the most innovative ways to deal with the pollution is the most effective approach.
What would you say to those who believe that cap and trade provides a license to pollute effectively?
I would say that's kind of the point. Not providing a license to pollute, of course, in the sort of the amoral sense of letting polluters get off the hook. Quite the opposite. It is a permission to pollute, but in very, very limited amounts, and of course, more limited than what we're doing right now. That is the key point, right? So if you look at the most effective way of decreasing emissions, for example, for sulfur dioxide, it was putting an upper limit on pollution, on SO2, sulfur dioxide emissions, and then handing out allowances to individual companies to comply with that law. And it was extremely successful. It decreased SO2 pollution by about half at a fraction of the cost, less than a third of the cost than was originally projected, and in a record time. And this might be the most significant item here, with almost perfect compliance. If anything, there was over-compliance in many ways of companies going beyond what they were obligated to do by the regulation.
In your view, what are the current political prospects of putting a cap-and-trade system into place at the federal level?
Well, let's turn to California here. As of last week, the California Air Resource Board has passed the final rule putting cap-and-trade, an emissions trading system, in place in California starting a year from now. You know, by some measures, California being the 8th or 9th largest economy on the planet, that is a pretty significant step. Now, true, we don't have cap-and-trade on the federal level, right? I won't be out of a job anytime soon because there's still clearly an uphill battle here. But even there, on sort of a national level, are hopeful signs. So, for example, Australia just this month passed a comprehensive carbon tax. Australia, of course, being one of the economies that has possibly the highest emissions intensity of any industrialized country. And it managed to pass a carbon tax. So do I see hope? Well, not in the sort of, you know, immediate term, as in will we have a cap and trade system in the next 6 or 12 or 18 months? Probably not, not on the federal level. But there's clearly a lot happening at the state level and also on the international level, with countries from India, which by now has a coal tax, to China, which is piloting cap and trade systems as part of its 12th five-year plan. In the end, it is the inevitable solution in many ways for the U.S., for Washington, D.C., to also embrace a system like that as the solution to global warming.
What are your ideas about getting the whole world to cap pollution that leads to global warming?
The fortunate thing here is that you look at around 4 or 5 countries or regions, I guess the EU in this case counting as one country, and those 5 countries and regions account for around 80% of global emissions. So would it be good to get 193 countries to agree on one uniform cap on pollution? Sure. It's certainly not realistic to aim for something like this. So instead, what we ought to do is focus on the handful of countries here, the US, the EU, China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, the handful of countries that truly matter here in terms of their own emissions, and in the end, possibly even focus on the 2 or 3 regions that also have the political clout to make a real difference. So in that sense, am I hopeful that we will have a global cap on emissions soon? Depends on what you mean by the global cap, right? If you're looking at sort of individual country measures in China, in the EU especially, which already has a cap and trade system in place, and of course also the US, that's a much more hopeful story here.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Gernot Wagner, author of the book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. Would you speak about what you consider to be the problems of an all-or-none conservation approach?
I guess the prime example here is setting aside land for preservation, or perhaps the UNESCO approach to preservation, which of course, right, if you are interested in preserving Mozart's birthplace in Salzburg or the Grand Tetons for that matter, right? So yes, absolutely, this is the way to go. You set aside the land and you've ensured that no one will touch that particular land. Now, the problem here is that approach simply doesn't work for something like overfishing, nor does it work for something like global warming. You can't set aside the entire atmosphere, of course, and setting aside portions of it is pointless. Right? So we are faced with this conundrum of having this fairly successful approach for preserving individual tracts of land be completely inadequate when it comes for something like global warming. That's the big problem here when we try to scale up this approach to the entire globe. And that's once again why markets for pollution, markets for pollution reduction especially, are the solution that avoids many of these pitfalls.
What do you see as the best way to approach the issue of trade-offs in conservation?
I guess one simple way of looking at this is looking at species conservation on an individual level versus species conservation on the level of an ecosystem, so biodiversity hotspots, for example. Right? There are clear trade-offs if you're looking at individual species. Right? We have limited conservation funds. We can't protect all species all the time. We need to pick our battles here, as it were. Now, it turns out ecologists, biologists, have done much of the work for us on this already and have identified something like 250 or so biological hotspots around the globe that are true havens of biodiversity and essentially harbor a large portion of species on the planet. So if you now look at this from an economics point of view and try to find a way to make your limited conservation dollars go further, here's your solution right there, right? You are to focus on those hotspots as opposed to trying to preserve individual species.
If we accept your premise that actions in our personal life are inadequate to save the planet, to what extent do you think personal actions to save the planet are of value?
They are of value, of course, if they get people excited to look at the larger changes that are necessary. Now, unfortunately, there is a pretty well-documented psychological phenomenon here at work called the single action bias. Right? You do one thing and you move on. That's a real problem here, right? If I've had plenty of conversations with people talking to me about what they do to protect the planet, right? And it's about recycling, it's about doing all the right things, right? Leaving your car at home on the weekend. So all these things, unfortunately, we can't stop there, right? We ought to be doing these things, but the point, of course, is we ought to be doing much, much more than just recycling, than just refusing the plastic bag at the checkout counter. We need to be doing much, much more, and in order to do that, we need real policy change. So yes, recycle, don't drive, bring your canvas back to the store, do all the right things. I'm doing all these things, right? I'm trying to do all these things as well. But in addition to changing light bulbs, we really ought to be changing laws here. So call your congressman, call your congresswoman, and make sure that we get these policy changes in place as well.
Did you yourself start out thinking that the individual action approach would be more effective?
Possibly not more effective, but I'm certainly someone who does do all these things as well, right? So I'm vegetarian. I don't have a driver's license. I don't drive. I don't have a stroller for my 7-month-old. We have a jogging stroller by now, but for the most part, we carry him around. So I do all these things as well. And looking at, for example, the fact that I don't have a driver's license, when I had the chance to get a license, I guess I still could get one, I suppose, at this point, but when I was 18 and was sort of deciding whether to do one or not, my reaction, sort of the environmentalist viewpoint here was, well, what if 1 billion Chinese started driving? Wouldn't that be a problem for the planet? So why should I drive? Well, turns out 1 billion Chinese are starting to drive, no matter whether I drive or not. Right? That's the problem here. We are on the verge of essentially doubling our vehicles from around 1 billion cars and individual vehicles right now to around 2 billion within the next decade, by 2020. And that's going to happen no matter what I do about my own driving behavior. So yes, right, am I proud of the fact and do I like to tell everyone about me not driving? Yes, of course, right? It makes me feel good, right? And I'd like to think that it's a good thing to do. It's the ethical thing to do. But as a policy solution, as a true solution to the problems here, we need to go much, much beyond that. We need to look to something like a gas tax, like a true limit on carbon emissions as the solution that would actually make a difference.
Would you give an example of how we can privatize social costs? How the cost of environmental damage can be shifted from society at large to the individuals who are causing it?
Sure. So one good example, and the bête noire here of the environmental movement, are plastic bags, right? And the right thing to do in many ways is to bring your canvas back to the store and refuse the plastic bag. Now, all of us, no matter how big an environmentalist we are, all of us forget sometimes to bring our canvas back to the store. Now, turns out that there's a pretty simple way to make people not forget here. Ireland, in 2002, introduced something called a plast tax, a 15 euro cent fee for plastic bags. But now, to keep pace with inflation, it's up to 22 cents. But still, it is a tiny, tiny fee, right? It shouldn't make a difference. When you purchase 100 euros, $100 worth of groceries, the 22 cents doesn't matter. Well, it turns out it does. That tiny policy change reduced plastic bag use in Ireland by 90%. 90. about 1 billion bags per year. That is a huge, huge shift for a small policy intervention. And by now, Washington, D.C., within its city limits, is the first American city that has a similar fee as well. In that case, it's on both plastic and paper bags. All disposable bags face around a 5-cent fee. And as a result, it's become the new normal to bring your own canvas back to the store. Right? You now stand at the register, and the clerk tells you, you do know, ma'am, that this will cost you 5 cents. Right? You are basically being reprimanded for not bringing your canvas back to the store. And guess what? People bring their canvas back to the store because of this simple policy change. Now, of course, we're talking plastic bags here, right? A billion of them, those of course make a difference. But still, it's not quite on the scale of trying to solve global warming here. But still, this is the exact same tool, the exact same policy intervention that would and does in fact work for something like global warming as well.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Keep recycling, keep doing all the right things, but in addition, study up on your economics and make sure that we do enact policy changes that do in fact make the planet notice, that make a difference on a planetary scale and will help us stop or at least limit the effects of global warming and many of these other global environmental problems that we are facing at the moment.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Gernot.
Thank you, Diane.
You have just been listening to Gernot Wagner, author of the book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World, published in 2011 by Hill and Wang. For more information, check on the web at www.maketheplanetnotice.com. Again, that's maketheplanetnotice.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.